Welcome to the Consulting Growth Podcast. I'm Professor Joe Omani, a professor of consulting at Cardiff University and an advisor to consultancies that want to grow. If you'd like to find more out about me and access some free resources to help your consultancy grow, do please visit joeomani.com. That's joeomahoney.com. Welcome back, everyone. It's a real pleasure today to have Meg Newhouse here. Meg started Inspirant Group about 7 years ago, and recently sold it to Ten Pearls, which Meg is an interesting company. Meg will tell us all about it shortly. So, Meg, first of all, welcome to the podcast. Lovely to have you on.
Thanks, Joe. It's so nice to be here. I appreciate the opportunity to chat with you today.
Thank you. So could you tell us a little bit about your background and how this led you to starting your own firm?
It's always so fun to like sit back and reflect on our origin story and how we got to where we are. And I don't know if we take a lot of time to do that. So thanks for the chance to go through it this morning. I was a psychology major. I was so certain that I was going to be a clinical psychologist with my own practice. I've always loved people. I've always wanted to help people. And I thought that was the way I would be able to do it. What happened though, during my junior year of college, I moved into the sorority house here in the States. And those of you who aren't part of the Greek system in the US, it is a lot like what you see in the movies, unfortunately.
What is it? Is it really? Wow.
But what happened was that I made some good friends and turns out I'm a really good listener and I'm pretty empathetic. And so much of my time was spent listening to my friends' problems and giving advice and coaching them through, which I was honored to do. But then I also, as the empath, started like wearing their emotions. I really, thank goodness for a 20-year-old, sat back and said, I don't know if I can do this for the rest of my life. So I went and spoke to my guidance counselor and they said, well, you know, you could do maybe like business psychology. What do you think about that? I'm like, I have no idea what you're talking about. And they're like, well, have you ever heard of human resources? So what that led me into was actually the field of instructional design. So I looked into human resources and using what I enjoyed doing and where I thought my talents were, I was a pretty decent writer. And I thought maybe I could write training programs and that would be my way of helping the world, right? Helping people learn their jobs better and feel like they knew what they were doing. I started doing that. And I did that. I went right into tech right out of school and really loved it. So I would say I turned like ones and zeros end user materials where people really understood how changes were going to impact them, you know, whether it was new technology or a new process. And I enjoyed doing that. I did that for a very long time, but then I got a little greedy. I wanted that title. I was in my late 20s and I felt like I'd served my time and earned my dues. And I left an organization I'd been with for a long time and went to big consulting. And it was like my husband said, he's like, you're going from JV to varsity. And I was like, what are you talking about? Yeah. And man, was he right. You know, I long hours, you know, busy. It was quite a grind. I learned so much. I'm really grateful for the time I spent there. And what that did is it showed me this idea of partnering with vendors for specialty skills. Even the big consulting firms bring in consultants on certain things. And I was like, oh, yeah, that's what I want to do. I want to be an instructional designer brought in on very specific projects to create end user materials. So I quit the big consulting, went out on my own, started my first business. It was a boutique learning and development consulting firm, single shingle for a while. I ended up bringing in a couple of subcontractors to help me on the bigger projects. And I did that for a long time, Joe, and really enjoyed it because I had the flexibility to choose the work that I wanted to do, thought I was doing valuable work. Mm-hmm. I missed part of a bigger team though. About 4 years in, I started looking to join a startup and the startup ecosystem here in Chicago is actually really great, really cool. Tech ecosystem's great. And I started kind of poking around. And during this time, a good friend of mine who was an executive at a healthcare company came to me and he's like, hey, look, I'm going to quit my job. And he was a client at the time paying me some good money. And I was like, don't do that. Wait, what?
Do it. Sure. Yeah.
And he's like, no, listen. He's like, I'm going to start a consulting firm because I think consulting can be done differently. I think it can be better. He had spent quite a few years at one of the big firms as well. We'd kind of been on both sides of the table. And he's like, let's do it better. Let's do it differently. Let's be people focused. He's like, I know people are your jam. I want you to come and help me build the culture and build this company and bring your learning and development background with you. And so that's how Inspirant Group was born in 2017. It took me like 30 seconds. I was like, yeah, let's do this. It's kind of exactly what I'm looking for at the time. Yeah.
Okay. Given you were in one of the big four, I think we can say Deloitte. I think that's fair enough.
It's out there on LinkedIn, isn't it?
Yeah, they're still going.
Yes.
So you could have stayed in the big corporates. What drove you to start your first firm and then be a co-founder of the new firm?
So when I joined Deloitte, I went into what they called a learning manager, and my skill set is in creating learning solutions. So being creative, coming up with unique, innovative ways to get the information to the end user. My role at Deloitte was managing deadlines in an Excel spreadsheet. So very different, not exactly what I had thought I was getting into. There was that. And then honestly, Joe, it was the hours. You know, I went from working pretty traditional 40-ish hour week to doubling that on a regular basis. And I had two young. Had I done this the reverse, like right out of school and the work hard, played hard mentality, it would have probably been a much different story. But at that chapter of my life, it just wasn't right. I was there for a glorious 10 months. Lucky, you know, and honestly, no disparagement. I mean, I don't think anything I'm saying is... It's surprising. I learned so much in those 10 months. And also, you know, the beauty of not burning bridges, as soon as I went on my own and started my own company, they did bring me right back in for a couple of years to help continue deliver on some of those projects as that vendor that I had seen when I was there. I was like, that's the guy I want to be.
Okay, brilliant. Thank you. This is a way of getting you to introduce Insprint Group as well. But so what did you start off doing versus what have you ended up doing? Did you start off with all three things as a focus? I'll let you introduce them, but all services as a focus. Did you have a phase where you just did anything to keep the cash coming through the door? Or were you like, we're starting in this niche and then we're building outwards?
No, that's a great question. So Insprint Group has three founders, which is why you have those three main
areas. Okay, right.
So we came together as this three-legged stool. Amir was the friend I was talking about with the initial idea. He reached out to me. So Amir has the strategy, the business ops, the business process. He reached out to me for the people side, the learning and development side. And then our third partner, Chris Van Avermaet, is the tech genius. And Amir and Chris know each other from their time at Deloitte as well. Chris was actually Amir's counselor at Deloitte. So that in common, even though I didn't work with the guys at Deloitte. So that was our three service lines. So we did have those offerings. I mean, as you know, and many of your guests have talked about as founders, you're hustling, you're taking what you can to get going those first couple years. But what we really wanted as a differentiator is we didn't want to be the yes men. We didn't want to take on things that we didn't have the skill set for. We're too old for that, right? Like we always call ourselves experience. We also had other partners within our network that we would source work out to if it wasn't in those. And then we started to build the team underneath that, right? And we were so fortunate that we had a compelling enough story where we were able to reach out to folks that we had worked with before that we knew they were good workers and they'd be a good cultural fit and build this really incredible team that was able, I think, to really make a difference in disrupting consulting, which is what we were setting out to do.
Okay, great. And how did you attract that team? Were these people that you'd worked with before? It's something that a lot of smaller firms struggle with, especially if you're used to having the big brand behind you. All of a sudden, no one's heard of you, and why should they come and work for you?
Yeah, so I'm so grateful for the opportunity I was given to build the culture from day one. You know, you talk to a lot of founders and chief HR officer, I was chief people officer. That is definitely not an early hire in the organization.
Sure, yeah.
But Amir knows. I mean, he knows companies are made up of people. So you have to get the people right in order to achieve the vision that you're set out to do. So I had carte blanche to create this culture. And from the get-go, we established our core values. And what that meant to us, it was the soul of the company. We had three core values: have integrity, care about the greater good, and get it done. And we had behaviors associated with those core values. And that's how people show up for each other every day. And then that just made it easy. That was like the secret sauce for the people we were looking to bring in. Most of the people we brought in were people we knew. It was people from our network that were looking for something different, right? They'd spent time at the bigger firms and knew that it could be better, knew it could be more people first, work-life balance. Like I said, we're all experienced. So a lot of us have families and kids, and like, we don't want to be traveling 4 days a week or grinding 80 hours a week. Yeah. You know, how can we find like really efficient, effective, smart people that can get their work done whenever, wherever, however, as long as they're delivering value? And we did it.
I should say for my, especially student audience in the UK and even more so in Europe, when you're working hard in the US in consulting, you're working hard. And that's not to say that consultants don't work hard in Europe, but you know, the holiday system is very different. The work-life balance, the law is very different, you know, say in France, where literally last week I had a conversation about utilization with a CEO. And can't remember what it was, but I think the maximum working week was something like 45 hours. And I was like, can I come and work? Can I come and work with you?
That's amazing. Well, honestly, Joe, to that end, you are absolutely right. Like, and I think it's well documented that in the States, work hard, right? Yeah. But what we did at Inspirant Group is we wanted to disrupt that. We wanted to show that we can still deliver values without the grind. And what the leadership team, Amir and Chris and I did every week and still do actually to this day is we get a utilization report and we take a look at anyone working over 40 hours. We reach out to their direct manager and we ask them what's going on.
This is really interesting. There's an expert in consulting in the US called David Fields. And I was chatting to him recently about this focus on utilization that so many firms have. And don't get me wrong, it's a KPI that needs to be looked at. But I always associate hammering down on utilization as a feature of a process-driven firm. Mm-hmm. You know, if you've got a high load of IP, if you're just turning the handle, and there's nothing wrong with that, utilization is core. But if you're a brains firm, you're solving problems. If you're an experienced firm, you know, you've got people who have been there and done that. I don't see utilization as a primary driver for a firm. I think that can be damaging rather than helpful.
I think we're a good example of that. And we find that, I mean, and again, I don't think this is any surprise. Nothing I say today, Joe, is going to be rocket science.
sometimes that's reassuring for people, yeah?
But you're going to get the best out of people when they are in control of their day. It goes back to hiring. You hire people you can trust to get the job done. We're not babysitters. Mm-hmm. You know, you hire adults to do the work that you agreed upon doing before they signed their contract. So let them do it. And then if they're not delivering, then you have a conversation. But we have, like I said, very smart, efficient, effective people. We're a brains organization. I love that. So let them do their job. And if it's taking more than 40 hours a week, let's talk about why.
Wow.
We get it done in 8 hours a day, don't you think?
Okay, that's great to hear. You're going to have a queue of ex-Big Four queuing up at your door now. Okay, tell me a little bit about the growth journey. Obviously, I mean, my view with three founders, it makes things a little bit easier unless you end up hating each other's guts, which obviously wasn't the case here. But what, I guess, looking back, are there things that you'd have done differently? Was it a completely smooth ride? Are there lessons that you would like to share with people who perhaps now have a 5 or 10 person firm that are looking to get to the 2030 mark?
Yeah. I mean, gosh, there's always lessons learned. I do think that if you are a solo entrepreneur, you need to be really honest with yourself about where you may be lacking in your skill set. And it's hard to do because I do think a lot of founders really optimistic, and with optimism comes sometimes a lack of complete self-awareness, maybe.
Sure.
And so you're either going to need to outsource those areas that you don't do well, or perhaps consider partners. I do think Amir, Chris, and I got very lucky. I didn't meet Chris until the day I signed, which was taking a leap, right? But I trusted Amir so much, and Chris, and vice versa, right? Chris trusted Amir so much that decided we could give this a try. The three of us established very early on to just be honest and transparent. And we have had a lot of difficult conversations, but it was always with respect. I mean, never anything brutal or painful. It was always three grown-ups working through whatever the trouble was that came our way. So I think that's really important as well, is something our team has always valued with us as well, is being transparent. So talking about, I mean, we made it through COVID, as a young, small company, lost money that year, right? But we were still able to keep our team, and we kept them informed every step of the way during that time. And I think that's sometimes hard to do, especially as a solo founder. Like, this is your baby, and it's hard to open the curtain and tell people what's going on behind there. But people, you know, hopefully you're hiring smart people. And if you are, they're going to appreciate being spoken to in that manner, that they're kept in the loop and they're part of that decision-making, right? I mean, that's another piece of it, especially with young companies. There's a source of pride in being one of the early employees for a startup. And people on our team, they're like, oh, I'm employee 4, I'm employee 8.
Yeah, sure.
They know this. And they'll say, you know, and they'll say this, I think, for years to come, like, oh, when Inspirant sold, I was employee whatever, you know. So having them feel as part of the conversation, part of the decision making, ultimately, right, you'll have the final decision, but getting that input and getting those ideas is incredibly helpful.
Now, listen, if you weren't focused on, you know, hammering utilization, You must have been focused on value to the client, and that must have enabled you to charge prices that kind of made up for the lack of, not lack of focus on utilization, but the strategic decision not to hammer people in terms of work. So did that mean that you weren't charging by the hour or by the day, or did you still do that, but you managed it slightly differently?
We have found, so we do have projects that are hourly, but we have found our best model is a fixed bid project, because that allows us in that way to control hours, resources,
you know, bring in.
Maybe we need to bring in QA just for a minute, you know, and then they need to come again or something like that. So that allows our team the flexibility. And we also do think it's a benefit to the client, because the client's like, okay, here's the chunk of money. I don't need to worry about you guys going over hours or anything like that. Like, we can just manage to the understanding that in 9 months for X number of dollars, we're going to get these deliverables.
Yeah, okay. You obviously didn't get much pushback against that. I mean, I personally find that clients prefer fixed pricing because it allows them to budget for it.
No, I mean, honestly, I do think even in the almost 7 years we've been in business, I've seen more of a shift to go to those fixed bids because of exactly that. We're talking to clients during budgeting time, which is coming up here soon. And we're like, hey, budget X amount. You want to get this done next year. It's going to cost this amount. It's just easy, right? Instead of like, oh, we think it's going to be this. We'll do our best, but we might, you know, we might need to ask for more money when it comes around. That's the more traditional consulting model. And again, I mean, we're evolving, right? Things change. Sure. So,
okay. All right. Thank you. I run a boutique leaders club. And whenever I have someone on, I hope you don't mind, I send them your LinkedIn profile and I say, any questions? If you don't mind, there's a few questions that some of them sent in.
You've already done it. Oh, no, good. This is great.
Yeah. No, so I wasn't going to bring anyone on and surprise you. And here is your old teacher who has something to say to you.
Imagine. I would actually love that. I have been wanting a roast for a very long time. So, Joe, if you could arrange that, that would be great.
No roasting here. Okay, so we have a question around incentives. So I think this is a more general question where very often the sale is incentivized, but there's so much work before the sale that needs to be done and should be encouraged, you know, and very often the person that does that work in terms of the meals, the introductions, the paper doesn't get rewarded. How did you manage that in your firm?
I would like to talk about the sale, but prior to that, I'd like to talk about the compensation model that Inspirant came up with, because I think it's quite unique.
Okay. And
so in speaking of incentives,
great.
Up until, I'd say, the first 3 years of the business, fairly standard. I mean, we had very few levels or roles, manager, director, partner, maybe. And you know, regardless of what that person in that role was doing, they had the same base salary. And then bonus was, you know, X percentage of salary. And then about 3 years in, we started looking at a new role called a practice lead. And that practice lead was managing a P&L. So then they would get a percentage of the profits of their P&L. That prompted a couple of the team members to come to the leadership team and say, so the practice line leads are really motivated to sell additional work and they receive the benefits of that. But then there's the rest of the team that's getting a more standard bonus structure. What if the profit sharing goes to everybody? What if we come up with a way to do that at the end of the year? And so we design the entire system as far as bonuses go. So base salaries, which we bump everyone pretty regularly, but then the bonus structure is a pool of profits that at the end of the year is shared out based on performance as well as longevity. So basically, you know, just being here, showing up, you get a certain dollar amount every year. But then, you know, there's a performance pool. And what that did, Joe, was honestly, most of the bonuses were fairly equal. So it made it very equitable for the entire team, regardless if someone was deep in delivery or someone was on the sales side.
Do you mean equal in terms of final amount, or do you mean equal in terms of percentage of salary?
Equal in terms of final amount.
Oh, wow. Okay. That's a nice place to be a consultant then.
You know, the first year we did it, when the leadership was kind of running the final numbers and getting everything closed the year out, because we're cash based, so cash everything out at the end of the year, it was like, wow. You know, we're like, oh, wow, this is great. Yeah. It really worked. And how cool for the team, because then at every single level, regardless, you know, most of our team is billable, but we have a handful of non-billable folks, regardless of what they're doing, they're giving it their all, because we all benefit, right? We all benefit when we're doing
that. Yeah, and it kind of also focuses the mind a little bit, I guess, on if this activity isn't adding value to the company, why the hell am I doing it?
100%. That's right.
Yeah, okay. And so did that account for the sale as well? So, you know, if someone landed a big deal, great, well done, thank you. But you'll see a reward for that in the final pool.
So there's only three partners and we used brokerage to sell. So really, the rest of the team wasn't aware of the sale until the sale actually happened.
I mean, not selling the company, making bids and winning. So we'll come to that, don't worry. But in terms of, I'm a senior, I land the client, I bring them in, they sign up with us. Do I just see, I saw my reward in the pool at the end rather than I get a cut of that deal?
No, there's also that. There's also sales percentage. Yeah. So there's a different percentage for new work versus repeat work, but there is an extra bonus for selling.
This is interesting. What was the difference on repeat versus, or do you remember what the difference was on repeat versus, you know?
Maybe 5% difference.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm pleased you reward it because in a lot of firms, repeat work is no one's interested, but as you get a new client, it might be half the amount of a renewal, but everyone's ringing the bell and running around wanting a bonus.
Yeah.
So it's quite nice to see them both being rewarded.
Well, work is work. I mean, right?
Yeah,
and
sure.
You have to, especially, I mean, so the folks who are getting that repeat work are often the directors who are running the team of people who are delivering so well that the client wants to keep us on. So should be a reward in that.
Okay, now you brought us into the exit side of things, which I'd love to jump into. So I've got another question from one of the members of the Boutique Leaders Club, which is, are there any key things with preparing for your exit that you wish you would have done, say 6 to 12 months prior to initiating the sale process that perhaps might have made it go smoother? I think I know who this is because he's in exactly that position right now.
Oh, okay. So you should know that we did engage a broker to help with our sale. And they're a sell side only broker based out of the States. And I'm happy to share the information.
Yeah, no, do please.
It was important when we first decided the right thing to do was to sell. We started kind of going at it on our own, you know, like, oh yeah, I know someone who sold and I'll ask them about it. And the reason I should even back up even more. The reason we chose to look for an acquisition was that we had reached a point in our growth that we felt like we had hustled as much as we could, you know, like we didn't see any, we could hustle harder, but we didn't see any change happening.
Yep.
And so we needed a larger organization to help us open doors, to help bring us into existing clients that needed to be the right sort of complementary services to, you know, what we didn't offer. Like we didn't want to join another consulting firm. We didn't want to get fired, you know, just get absorbed into that. We wanted to still be the consultants, but as part of a different kind of larger ecosystem.
Yeah.
So to the acquisition story, when we decided to do this, we didn't tell the team. And this was based on some advice, as well as the fact that the three founders had decided, should we not find the right partner, we're not going to do this. Like we are fine operating as is, and we don't want to upset anybody, you know, for no reason.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I, you know, it's something I advise all of my clients that no matter how much you're trusted, how big friends you are, once word gets out, simply because it's an unknown, people get jittery.
That's right. And we just needed the team to focus on the work.
At
this, when it was time to tell them, we would tell them. So anyway, we kind of stumbled around for a few months trying to make this happen on our own. And man, I have to tell you that salesperson from the firm we used reached out on LinkedIn and was very persistent. And finally, I was like, fine, we'll have a conversation. And
okay.
This is one example, and I don't want to encourage people to continue.
Sure. Yeah, yeah.
Because it is, in general, quite annoying, but it was just right person, right time.
Your LinkedIn box is going to be buzzing now with all types of us.
Already is. You should know I don't look at my LinkedIn inbox. So just FYI, in general, right? I would say to folks that are starting to consider the sale, if you're really serious and you want to make something happen pretty quickly, use a brokerage. Now, the hard part is giving up a percentage of the sale. And I understand that. But as I was speaking with my partner, you know, it's like selling a home, right? Like do you want to do for sale by owner?
Yep.
Well, like maybe it's in the States, right? So when you use a real estate agent, they get a percentage of the sale.
Yep.
So, but if you do for sale by owner, it could sit on the market for months and months and months, and maybe you lose value and, you know, miss the right opportunity. The benefit we found with using this brokerage was that they had a team of people that put together the sales materials for us and then a database of interested buyers. And then they brokered the discussions. And I tell that, you know, when we closed and had to hand a chunk of change over to the brokerage, I reminded the guys like 10 Pearls would never have found us had we not used them. Yeah, and they were absolutely the right company to acquire us. They were exactly what we were looking for.
That's fantastic. Just two quick things here. Number one, there's a lot of statistical research that shows that using a broker, despite the fees, even when the fees are taken into account and the lawyers and all the rest of it, generates prices 15% higher than not using a broker. So that's the first thing. But I also remember I was using the house selling analogy with a guy called Paul Beaumont, who founded Equitech, which are one of the biggest M&A firms for professional services and tech. And he said, you're right, it's just like that, except your home doesn't go down in value because you're selling it. When you're selling a business, if you take your eye off the ball because you're trying to sell the business and you're not getting it in, your value goes down. So it's even more. The consequences can be even worse if you're trying to sell it yourself.
Great point. Because I have to tell you, even using the brokerage, it took a lot of our time because you have to. So first, you know, they put together all the sales materials. And so reviewing that, making sure they got the story right. So there's two pieces, right, that they used. It's the teaser, which has no identifying information, but it's enough to wet someone's whistle to want to continue the conversation. And once someone is interested in talking, then the brokerage reaches out and says, are you interested? If so, let's sign the NDA, do that. Then they send this 30-page marketing brochure, the SIM, for the potential buyer to review. So you really want to get that story right. So that took months to work regularly with the brokerage. And then depending on how deep you want to go, like we had, I mean, first of all, we to review the companies that were interested in talking to us, that takes time. And then have the conversations, you know, to set up to even schedule those conversations, honestly, with the three founders. So there's three of us, plus from outside, plus the brokerage, you know. So all that being said, Joe, just to underscore, you're absolutely right. Like we used a brokerage and it took a lot of our time. I can't even imagine if we were trying to navigate that.
Yeah. And what I see, and in fact, it's quite sad when people come to me afterwards. So very often you'll have someone, either someone who comes to me and says, right, I'm ready to sell my firm. And you look at the firm and say, well, it's making money, but it's not ready to sell because they've had no advice. And so that's the first thing. But secondly, you'll very often get someone who will had a great firm. They've tried to sell it themselves. It's fallen through because they've taken their eyes off the ball. Sales have gone down. Margins gone down. A few key people might have left. And then you're stuck there a year and a half later and you're trying to sell something that's gone down in value and no one's going to want to buy that.
I've not thought about it that way. And I think that's absolutely right.
Yeah, you definitely did the right thing. I'm a big believer in brokers. And if you're bigger, getting the banks involved. And it is talking to a client at the moment. And I just told them how much the lawyers would cost. Forget about the bank's cut. And you could see there are.
Yes. Yeah, it's a little painful at the end of it. But again, I mean, I just keep coming back to you. Like, we wouldn't have found this perfect partner had it not been for the broker.
Cool. Yeah, great. Okay. Good. And one of the questions I was asked to ask was in terms, now you might have been quite early on in what I'm calling a recession, but officially isn't a recession, but certainly in the UK and the US, a lot of consultancies are finding it quite hard now. You chose to sell, I guess you chose to sell in 2022 and then the deal was done in 23. Is that right?
Yeah, it was late summer of 22 when the three of us agreed, let's give it.
Oh, okay. So that actually was an ideal time to do it in many ways, wasn't it? I mean, I don't know about your specific sector, but in terms of the consulting market as a whole, there's a lot of firms out there that are struggling. But did you give, how much thought did you give to timing in terms of market trends, waiting for potential buyers to be in the right place to buy? Or was it all done quite quickly? Was it quite a tight deal?
It was done very quickly. And we did take the looming recession into account. We were worried that our business would slow and we become less attractive.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that potential buyers would get scared. And I do think actually a few of them did, even during the process. We had some good conversations and then they went silent. So we got, I think in many, many ways, we got lucky, right? I think success in business, it's a lot of right time, right people. And of course, there's a little bit of luck. So I think that the time we chose, you know, the recession was being discussed, but not as much of a looming threat. But I think honestly, when we were in the thick of the sale was really when people were starting to tighten the belts a bit.
Okay, now you're on the other side. Tell us a little bit about 10 Pearls, because it's an interesting company. Am I wrong? Is it based in Germany or Oslo?
So 10 Pearls was co-founded by two brothers in Pakistan.
Oh, wow. So, okay.
I built the business for about 9 years in Pakistan as an offshore resource to compete with India. What's great is that there aren't many Pakistani competitors as there are in India. So it's not like there's Pakistani Google or Amazon. Yep. So Tech Worlds was able to really grow and become that resource, as well as in school, you know, folks are learning English as soon as they start school. So the English is very well spoken and folks are easy to communicate with. So Brothers had major success, and also founded the company, tech company, app development, staff aug, with a generous heart. So they wanted to give back right away. The brothers wanted to give back to their community. They provided, starting from day one, when they were working out of their home, their mom would provide lunch every day, you know, to the guys in the next room, the coders. And to this day, now we're almost 20 years in, they still do lunch every day in their Pakistani offices. Another big piece, the brothers look to their mom as a big inspiration in their lives. And so they focus, especially in that region, on promoting women in tech. And so they have a lot, even from day one, they started all of these initiatives around women in tech, 40% of their
development
in Pakistan. So that spoke to Inspirant, because Inspirant's a people first company as well. So first and foremost, our culture, our values needed to align. But then they're also the back end of digital transformation that we didn't have, right? We don't have a dev shop. You know, we didn't have hard coders like that, right? Those were things that we needed to outsource. So, and they didn't have that front end strategic consulting. So it really now, you know, with the acquisition of Inspirant, Temporals is able to provide this end digital transformation.
Okay. What did they see in you that attracted them to you? So obviously you had good people, you were in a nice niche, you'd grown relatively quickly over 5 or 6 years, but what was it above and beyond? Because I'm guessing there's quite a few companies that would have ticked those boxes. What is it above and beyond that attracted them to you?
To hear Imran, the CEO, tell it is, so Temporals is their story is really interesting as well. Maybe you'll have Imran in at some point. But so he and his brother Zeeshan started the company 9 years in Pakistan, and then decided, even during the pandemic, they decided to double down on growth, and they started acquiring. And Joe, over the course of 3 years, they acquired 12 companies.
Wow.
So they left just focused in Pakistan, and they started acquiring nearshore. So they've got some LatAm companies that they've acquired. They've acquired in the US, and they most recently acquired a company in the UK. And they focused on growth and really doubled down on that. Their model is super interesting in these acquisitions, because they look for founder-led companies that have been successful, such as Inspirant Group, with similar values, right? People first, with the way they treat their employees, as well as the way they interact with their clients. And then they bring them in and let these companies continue to run in their successful way, but now with like the support of the Temporals ecosystem. So Imran said his famous line is 1 + 1 = 11. So you bring in these organizations and let the entrepreneurs continue to be creative and innovative, but now as part of almost 1600 person organization, continuing to deliver in their unique ways, but also collaborate, cross-sell, and use the benefit of the greater good.
That's fantastic. I had heard of the company, but I didn't know the backstory, and I didn't even know it was a Pakistan company to start off with, which is amazing. They've done so well, and especially opening up into the people side of things and expanding internationally. I'm going to have to get them on, aren't I? I really want to talk about your next step. I realize you're with Temporals, and you know there's a great thing there. Do you ever think about going back to psychology or a big change, or are you going to keep going the way you've started here?
Oh, Joe, that's a great question. Well, let me say, I do use my psychology degree every day.
I bet you do. Yeah, sure. Well,
that hasn't gone by the wayside by any means. No, I have a real soft spot and passion for executives during my career in the work that I've done. So, you know, as I was talking about starting out as an instructional designer, having my boutique learning and development consulting firm prior to Inspirant Group, I did a lot of the tech training and development that I had been doing, but I did start to make my way into leadership development and really focusing on what makes a good leader. And then thinking about where we are in our lives, you know, when you talk about people moving into these executive roles, they're often, you know, maybe they have a family, maybe they're caring for aging parents, you know, maybe they have a mortgage, and, you know, all the things they have to think about and worry about. And how often they don't deal with their stuff. You know?
Yeah.
I don't know what that means. Like, I'm really loving what is going on with Inspirit and Ten Pearls and what the future holds. And there will be some time here to really dedicate to the integration of Inspirant Group and as well as the other acquisitions and bringing 10 Pearls to that next level. So I don't see that going away anytime soon, but I can take this passion for overall executive well-being, I think is what it is. I'm a yoga instructor as well. So you bring you bring that piece into it. You know, your overall, like, life should be fun. Like, you should be healthy and happy, and how I could maybe take my experience and help folks who might be struggling and get to that point.
That's fantastic. I'll have to introduce you. There's a wonderful woman called Sarah Matthew who sold her own marketing company about, must be 7 or 8 years ago now. And I mean, wonderful woman, but has great, she's a biochemist or pharmaceuticals they used to do the marketing for, and she's done that by training, so she knows all about the human system, but has kind of got into the leadership from a leadership coaching from a psychological perspective. So I'll introduce you to her because she's fascinating.
Just right up my alley. I would love that. Thank you.
Listen, thank you so much for your time, Meg. We've learned a huge amount, and I can only wish you all the best going forward with 10 Pearls, and really appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you for the opportunity. And if anyone listening cares to connect on LinkedIn, I'm happy to do that. I will read your email if you're not trying to sell me something.
I'll put your contact details up on the show notes. Thank you.
Thanks, Joe.
Take care. Bye-bye.
As ever, thank you for listening to the Consultancy Growth Podcast. This is Professor Joe Omani at joeomani.com.